Welcome to episode 226 of Troubadours and Raconteurs, with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. On this week's program, we have our regular contributor, our resident philosopher, Almighty Todd from Stockbridge, Vermont, talking with us about Quebec, about glaciers and fjords, about Putin, Vladimir Putin, if you will, about global warming, Asian thought juxtaposed with the DC politic, as well as harmony of life, and enjoying our brief time here. We also have an EW essay titled FTE Surreptitiously, a poem titled Viva, and an excerpt from the Dhammapada, chapters 1 and 2, on twins and awareness. All of this, as is usually the case, is ensconced within several great tunes. Nice to have you with us. Let's get to it. Episode 226 of Troubadours and Raconteurs.
Wanna be better than oxygen, so you can breathe when you're drowning and weak in the knees. I wanna speak louder than Ritalin for all the children who think that they've got a disease. I wanna be cooler than TV for all the kids that are wondering what they're going to be. We can be stronger than bombs if you're singing along and you know that you really believe. We can be richer than industry as long as we know that there's things that we don't really need. We can speak louder than ignorance because we speak in silence every time our eyes meet. On and on and on it goes. The world, it just keeps spinning until I'm dizzy, time to breathe. So close my eyes and start again anew. I wanna see through all the lies of society to the reality happiness is at stake. I wanna hold up my head with dignity, proud of a life where to give means more than to take. I wanna live beyond the modern mentality where paper is all that you're really taught to create. Do you remember the forgotten America? Justice, equality, freedom to every race. Just need to get past all the lies and hypocrisy, makeup and hair, to the truth behind every face. Then look around to all the people you see. How many of them are happy and free? I know it sounds like a dream, but it's the only thing that can get me to sleep at night. I know it's hard to believe, but it's easy to see that something here isn't right. I know the future looks dark, but it's there that the kids of today must carry the light. On and on and on it goes. The world, it just keeps spinning until I'm dizzy, time to breathe. So close my eyes and start again anew.
FTE Surreptitiously. So, my fellow working class, middle class, lower to upper, can we now accept that it is clear this Trumpian attempt at disoriented conquest is not in line with our best interests? Are we courageous and patriotic enough to admit when we are wrong, and true enough to support what we talk, i.e. walk, the mother blipping walk. You are not racist, are you? You are not a plebe being manipulated by some half-witted club of white men who behind the facade think they are better than you, as they use you to serve their needs, wants, and selfish machinations, are you? Don't be afraid of the higher powers. Do not be misdirected. Do not prostrate or prostitute yourself. Your mind, your rights, your soul, the dreams and struggles of your ancestors, so that you end up a pig-headed mark of sourpuss rubes with empty hearts. Have some integrity, respect for yourself, and the best ideals of our country. F.T.E. surreptitiously. Is this Almighty Todd?
Hello, Conundrum.
Hey, how's it going?
Going all right. How are you?
Good. Nice to have you on Troubadours and Rock on Tours once again. A regular contributor. Our resident philosopher. Farmer. Oh, God, so many things. Just a very, like I've said in the past, a Batman. Renaissance man. Batman.
Madman.
Oh, Madman. Batman. Madman. And you just were on a journey. You're up in Quebec and through New England. A little Chilean grapes involved. We're going to talk about those things. We're going to talk about Eastern philosophy and D.C. politics and wherever else we go, who knows. It's nice to have you back.
Oh, it's good to be talking to you again.
So you were in Quebec with your probation officer, right?
Yes, they let me out.
They let you out. And tell us a bit as to, you know, why and what you saw, why you went up there and what you saw.
Well, growing up in upstate New York and having family up on Lake Champlain, that we were so close to the Canadian border that and knew people from Quebec. I took French in high school because I thought I would be useful at some point, and then never really was. But it has become so in time. As I visited Quebec periodically, mostly it was always trips to Montreal because it was so close to home. But last year, for the first time, we went to Quebec City in the winter for the Winter Carnival, because that's a famous couple-week event that they have around Mardi Gras time. And that was pretty fascinating, seeing the old city and pretty vibrant place. Even in the winter, people are riding their bikes around, you know, it's snowing. It's pretty crazy in that respect. They're intrepid. And we decided to go up this time of year and also go a little bit farther than Quebec City, out to the Saguenay Fjord, which is this amazing natural wonder. It's a rift valley left from the original continent building that dumps out into the St. Lawrence Seaway, which makes it actually very unique among fjords because it doesn't dump directly into the ocean. And it goes, it's like an hour and a half drive up to the end of the fjord where there's a big bay and where the Saguenay River pours into it. And that's just one of many water sources. It's a massive watershed that pours into this fjord. So consequently, it has like the top 10 meters of water are fresh water, and then the next 20 meters are brackish. And then everything beyond that, which could be anywhere from 50 to another 200 meters deep, is seawater, salt water, and highly oxygenated seawater at that, because it's got all this fresh dumping into it. So it makes for a very complex marine environment, the point where they have whales in the fjord. And the belugas come in and have their young in there, and they get minke whales and humpback whales. They even get blue whales in this little fjord, you know, the biggest animals on Earth. And it reminded me a lot of Lake Champlain topographically, because the rock is the same kind of rock as the Adirondacks. It's the oldest surface rock on the planet, and it's been deformed by time and the glaciers, and just beautifully, landscaped by the natural creation up there. I highly recommend just looking up pictures of it. And if you're interested in, you know, going to a place that's out of the country and speaks a different language, just to kind of reset your visor a little bit in terms of how other people live, it's pretty cool. And, you know, people are extremely welcoming. And, you know, Canadians are nice anyways, and the Quebecois, if you even try a little bit with your French, I felt like were really helpful and very gracious and hospitable. So there's that part of it. And if you like poutine, you got to go, you try out poutine in every little town or restaurant.
You're talking about Vladimir Poutine?
Yeah, Vladimir Poutine. Exactly. No, do you know poutine?
No.
I don't know poutine. No. I've never seen him. I've never talked to poutine.
I've never spoken to poutine. No. He's a small man.
Yeah. Well, you can get a small or a large.
Okay.
And then there's also the familial size, too. But, poutine is basically, and there may be some version of this in your neighborhood, because I grew up with a version that I didn't realize that's what it was, but it was basically fries and gravy.
Oh, yeah, fries and gravy
are big. Have you had fries and gravy?
Oh, they're big here in Scranton, Pennsylvania.
Well, okay, this poutine is like it's fries and gravy. It maybe is the original fries and gravy. Don't tell anybody I said that. But what they do is they put cheese curd, little, you know, balls of cheese curd on it. So they get kind of melty and they're still kind of, squeaky and fresh. It's delicious. And sometimes they'll put smoked meat on it.
Oh, man.
You want? Yeah.
Isn't it funny how, food dishes often are very erotic sounding?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's a, how can you say, gustatory experience is a hedonistic experience, but not in like the overdone way. It's just, it's hedonic in that how we experience it, on a visceral level.
Yeah. It's definitely a very visceral sort of pleasure, no doubt. And how do you spell poutine?
P-O-U-T-I-N-E.
P-O-U-T-I-N-E. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
And you went up there with your beautiful wife, right?
Yep. She'd been pining for that. We had such a good time in Alaska, but we're not going to go that far. And she wants to go to Norway someday because she wants to see the fjords there. And so I've been telling her for a couple of years, hey, there's this fjord in Quebec. And she's like, what, are you kidding? There's no fjord in Quebec. So I finally made, showed her the thing. And she's like, wow, there's a fjord in Quebec.
God damn it, honey, there's a fjord in Quebec, and I'm going to show you. She totally got you. There isn't. She totally just manipulated your male mind to get it up there. Yeah, good job. Now, for those of us who aren't geologists, who aren't topography experts, who aren't ecologists, any of those things, explain what a fjord is.
Basically, it's a big, long, deep, narrow passage of water, relatively narrow passage of water that's seawater, and it usually has high cliff walls on either side, because I believe it's because I know that this one is a rift valley, but that may be what makes fjords fjords. They'll often have been acted upon by the glaciers, which will maybe exacerbate their depth and the sheerness of cliffs, but round them at the tops, and you'll get all these little bays and coves in them as the glacier worked, softer material as they advance and retreat. So, I mean, this fjord, like I said, it's 250 meters deep in some places. So that's that's deep. So I don't know the conversion exactly, but you're talking, over 750 feet deep.
Yeah.
And then the cliffs on the sides of it can go up to 1,200 feet at some point. But that distance there, you'd have to go four more times as high to be where the top of the glacier was.
Wow. So it's a remnant. It's a remnant.
Yeah. Yeah, well, the glacier has left its footprint on something that's a much older thing. The Rift Valley itself, I think, is like 450 million years old. Yeah. There was also a place up there in the St. Lawrence Seaway. If you look at a map of the St. Lawrence, go from Montreal to Quebec City, and then you'll see the St. Lawrence gets a lot wider all of a sudden.
Mm-hmm.
An asteroid hit there.
Wow. Wow.
And flattened, if there was a crater that rebounded, so there's a ring cut out of the mountains, and there's a dome in the middle of it.
Before the river was there, or while the river was there, the asteroid hit?
That's a good question. No, it would have been, they said that one was 450 million years ago. So, yeah, the St. Lawrence River is younger than that. I don't know how much of it was definitely, because it's at the kind of like the edge of the North American plate, and the way the plate stretches and ripped a little bit created a place for that, and then the glaciers, of course, did more. I need to go back and learn more about the overall geology of the specific geology of the St. Lawrence, because I know kind of the context for it, but I'll tell you that you could see the marks of the glacier everywhere. There were places up on top of mountains where there were just these long, straight lines across the exposed bedrock, like somebody dragged a comb through it.
See, this is what we have to look for as a result of global warming. We're going to be able to see these things in our, in our lifetime.
Oh, yeah, there will be places, or you can go now to places like Alaska, to the glaciers that you can get to the edge of, and you can see as they've receded the lines that they left. In one case, we saw one where you could see that there was still a rock trapped in the ice, and you could see how that rock being dragged was causing a scrape line, really slowly, but albeit, you could see a few feet of a scrape.
That's when you were up in Alaska.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, this makes me sound like I'm some kind of world traveler, but by no means. That was a crazy one. But we're going to go back to Quebec again because it's nearby. It's drivable distance. I mean,
yeah, you're in Vermont, Stockbridge, Vermont. So it's, three, 4 hours?
Quebec City is about 4.5 hours from where we live. So it's about the same as driving to New York.
Yeah.
And then getting to out further, the Saguenay is only a couple more hours. So it's pretty reasonable in that respect. And right now, the currency exchange rate still makes it also more affordable. It's like a 25% discount on everything you do up there.
Oh, nice. Nice.
Yeah, and the food is reasonably priced, and the wine is reasonably priced, and gas is a little bit more expensive, but not terribly. So, and lodging is pretty reasonable. So it's, you know, if you're not feeling, you want to go for a trip and don't want to fly anywhere, and you're on the East Coast, it sure is an option, although you could fly into Quebec City and then probably rent and drive from there. It's beautiful, wild country.
Now, from there, you went to Connecticut.
Well, actually, came back home first.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, I did come back home first and had to grab the other car, and then today drove down to Connecticut and back to go pick up the grapes.
The Chilean. What kind of
Chilean
grapes?
Chilean wine grapes. We got some Malbec. We got some Carmenere, we got some Syrah, and some Cabernet Sauvignon.
Now, you have a connection to Chile. Your wife is Chilean, right?
No, she's Hawaiian.
She's Hawaiian. Her father's Chilean.
Nope, he's Nebraskan.
There's a connection. I
know.
He works in Chile.
Yeah, he worked in Chile.
He worked
in Chile for a long time at one of the telescopes. He moved down there in the mid-70s and still down there now.
Okay.
He's retired. And we had visited many years ago, and that was at the time when I was really getting into wine, and that opened me wide open. And so then after I started making wine, and then I was looking around for where can you get stuff, one spring I saw this ad in 2009 for these guys down in Connecticut that usually bring in the Californian grapes to the East Coast in the fall, and they were going to start bringing Chilean grapes north. And I was like, well, hey, I got to try and get in on that. So I did a little experiment, came out pretty good, doubled what I was going to do the next year, got really good. Some friends helped me do some destemming, and I said, hey, can we get some grapes too, and we'll make this wine? And I said, okay, so that's where we're at. So we'll have a little neighborhood gathering tomorrow evening and destem the grapes.
Yeah. And I mean,
if somebody wants to stomp on them, they can.
So now you get to make wine twice a year, basically.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
This is where the madman part is, because if you're a winemaker, you're like, what, twice a year? I mean, that's cool, but it's also like you get these kind of traffic control problems in the cellar. Stuff's going down at the same time other stuff's coming up.
You're a big wine guy, you know. I mean, you've written a book, Wines of Vermont, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
I love the book. It's so well written, and the history as well as the different types of grape. It's a wonderful book. And you have sort of a little media operation, Vermont Wine Media, and you travel around, you talk to some pretty hefty people in the wine world, the New York Times wine critic you've had interactions with. What's the woman's name? Deidre? Is that her name?
Yeah, Deidre. My friend Deidre Heekin, yeah.
She's written a highly acclaimed book on winemaking, too, I believe.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you're a big wine guy. On top of being a geologist, a world traveler, a farmer, a philosopher, and the wine, the Chilean grape. Now, is your next wine sort of venture? And what type of wine will come of it? Will it be a red? Will it be a rosé, a white, or are you going to have a couple different?
Well, I do a couple different things with the same grapes. I have a little thing I've worked out that I think is a pretty fun way to get a few different things out of the same ingredients, so to speak. So, yeah, we do what's called carbonic maceration, which is kind of the style of Beaujolais Nouveau where you put the grapes in a carbon dioxide environment, and I just do that by starting some juice fermenting in the bottom of a big bin. You put the grapes in on top, and you seal it up tight. And what happens is there's an enzymatic process that starts to transform sugar into alcohol without the yeasts doing it. So it's a non-metabolic process. It's just like it's an enzymatic process. And so then it retains a little more fruitiness and does some nice textural things for the wine. And then we crush it down after a couple of days and let it continue on its way. That's one way. And then we also do one where it's traditional red wine maceration. You destem it, you crush it, soak it, you know, let it ferment on its skins, let it soak a little longer, and then press it off. So that's your traditional red maceration. And then what we do is we take the skins from those first two and throw them in a tank and have some Merlot juice that's already been cold pressed and cold soaked down in Chile and comes in a bucket. Mm-hmm. And it's okay on its own, but it doesn't really make a robust wine. So what we do is like they do in Italy with Rapasso, where they take the the Corvina or Rondinello or some other grape and pass it over the Amarone skins. You know Amarone?
Mm-hmm.
The heavy, yeah. So you pass that grape over the Amarone skin and let it ferment a little longer. It picks up some of that richness of the skins. So we do the same thing with the skins and the Merlot juice, and that becomes the second run wine, which seems like the one everybody likes best right off the bat.
Do you take it to the grappa stage?
That's not legal in the United States to do at home.
FTE.
Yeah.
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 An acronym.
Yeah. So that's just, you know, one of those things that prohibition never got that far. You were always able to make some wine and beer at home or wine at home during prohibition, but
not distilling.
Distillation is still under tight control because it's kind of like printing money in a way. And that's why even if, you know, as soon as you make it, you got to pay taxes on it. And you got to hold a bond and all that stuff.
So your answer is no, you don't make grappa you're not going to admit to it. Okay.
At least I couldn't do it legally.
Well, in Vermont, you guys do what you want. You guys are like...
People are known to do things out in the woods.
Yes, I'd imagine.
You make syrup.
Is that what you call it? Yeah. Almighty Todd, ladies and gentlemen, talking with us about his trip to Quebec, fjords, Vladimir Putin, fries and gravy, whatever you choose, some glacier movements, and Chilean grapes and wine making right now. I want to get to, because you're a person who can go a lot of different places. That's one of the reasons I really enjoy talking with you. Let's go to Eastern philosophy juxtaposed with the D.C. political machinations at present.
Yeah, I kept thinking about how to approach that. And there's a few precursors that I think have to be gone over before it can have a discussion like that. But that might be a discussion in itself.
Well, go for it.
But coming off of glacial pace, definitely what's going on with the investigations in the House and the Senate is really a joke at this point. And the fact that they don't want to entertain the idea of an independent investigator because it would make the ongoing investigations look bad.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, anyways, I'll back it up and try to answer your question, or at least spark some conversation around it. But Eastern philosophy and the D.C. political climate. Well, there maybe are things that could be studied in Eastern philosophy that could be applied to it. But first, we have to take a step back and recognize that the idea, Eastern philosophy, is a concept that is a couple hundred years old, and it comes out of the West, and it's basically positing that everything that is what would be considered Asian thought is somehow collected as a philosophy, which really it's not. And there are some people that even argue that philosophy is strictly a domain of the Western the Western construct, yes.
Yeah. Do you agree with that?
Well, in what we consider philosophy to be, in terms of maybe long, drawn-out, logical progressions of thought structures, and that maybe Asian thought doesn't necessarily or can't really be categorized in the same way, and so that it's better to instead of saying Eastern philosophy or Oriental philosophy, is to say Asian thought, because it is a quite wide sphere of different kinds of thinking. And so Asian thought itself is broken down from a Western categorical perspective into two areas. One is Eastern Asian thought and Southern Asian thought. And the Eastern Asian side, you know, is pretty much is like your Chinese thought, Japanese thought, Korean. And then South Asian is India, Indonesia, Nepal. And so they're kind of different families that are built, probably you think of it geographically because of where those, how the landform has divided up populations. And, you know, even within Chinese thought, there are many schools of thought, and then there are things that aren't schools of thought, really, because, you know, you could consider Taoism a school. There's a, you know, a philosophical bent to Taoism, and there's also a religious bend to it, and those two aren't always in the same, don't always line up the same way, or one is more abstract and the other one has more, quote-unquote, practical applications. If, you know, if I asked you about Confucius, what would be your impression of Confucius? If, you know, I would put that to you.
I don't know. Confucius is like the stereotypical sort of reference point when people talk about Eastern thought or Asian thought. I don't know how I would categorize.
Okay, so yeah, so that's, you know, often the case. I think we know that that's the thing, but it's not, we're not sure what that means. So Taoist thought, like we were just talking about, is built quite a bit around the idea of the yin-yang, and that there is a harmony to nature and to life itself, and that what we want to try and do is figure out how to align ourselves with that harmony of nature in such a way to live the highest form of life possible with the least amount of conflict. That's a condensation. And that's where you get your, you know, your the Taoist text, which is basically a bunch of poems, or like, it's like trying to formulate Christianity out of just some of the Psalms.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, a lot of interpretation goes into what those all mean, or how you use those in either an abstract way or in a practical daily way. Then you've got Confucius, who really is, he was more developed a logical ethic. It was basically about ethics, and that trying to live the highest life possible meant trying to live in as righteous a way as possible in terms of being a good person, but also to search out knowledge and to learn as much as possible. And by doing those things, you are contributing to the betterment of society and the world. So in terms of the current politic of the U.S., I would say that we're pretty much diametrically opposed. Part of the righteousness is being, you know, truthful and honest at, mm-hmm, all times. So would be diametrically opposed to, or the yang for the yin, in this case, of philosophies or practice. But that, and from his perspective, it was...
Is yang the darkness?
Yang's usually, yeah. Well, this is one of those things where there's different schools interpret that different ways. But yeah, often the yang is the darkness. Yin yang.
Yin yang.
Yin yang, yeah. So, but even Confucius's school, even though it remains famous, was one of a number of other schools of thought and ethical practice, ethical life style that were eventually overcome by a dynasty change, and an overarching philosophy of legalism came into play. And actually, it didn't matter what was moral anymore; it was mattered what was in the law. And at that time, like, everybody in China was a lawyer. If you weren't a laborer, you were a lawyer. But, that eventually fell away, too, because it was a couple hundred years, if I remember correctly, of that China was ruled by an explicitly stringent legal society where everything was regulated. So I also think that that's, you know, the complete opposite of where certain people would want to be going at this point in D.C. So I think what you could do is you could look around in different areas of Asian thought, and you'd have to pick one and look at it for a while and use it as a reference point. But even so, I don't know if that isn't in itself kind of a Western deconstruction, that, well, I can kind of grok this thing and then use it over here. That's kind of what they were doing, the Wall Street traders reading The Art of War during the 80s.
Yeah, Sun Tzu.
Yeah, I can get some ideas out of this and I can use them or, commoditize them or make, somehow use them for competitive advantage.
Which is contrary to the whole essence.
In some cases, yeah. Yeah, because in case of Sun Tzu, it was like even when you went into battle, you did it. You tried to do it in such a way that the least amount of life was lost and the least amount of resources were consumed.
Yeah.
And that was definitely not necessarily how people applied it to the machinations of the market at that time. So, yeah, I mean, it's always a hard jump to try and, take a quick stab at somebody, at some, unfamiliar line of thinking and use it as a way to, as a touch point. But that said, it can be an interesting exercise. Don't try to take it too seriously, because there's definitely people that spend years and years studying it. Speaking of which, I would say that Xi Jinping studied a lot more history than our president did.
Who did you reference?
Xi Jinping, the president of China.
Yeah.
He's probably done a lot more history.
Yeah.
Study.
Yeah. When he was in the company of our president, I'm sure he knew he was with a smaller man. But they have to deal.
And they do have a sense of history. So it's not just philosophy, at least with the Chinese, they have a very, very long arc of history and can continuity of civilization, so to speak. Upheavals, yes, but it's still, it's a perspective that, even having studied, I still don't even believe I can wrap my head around in terms of
experience.
How we're seen from such a long-standing civilization.
Right. We're kids, comparatively.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, we only have a few seconds, really, to go. So how do we wrap it up, then? How do we bring Quebec, Chilean grapes, glacier movement, Asian thought, and D.C. all together?
Whew, boy. I don't know. That's a good one, except that, it's easy to get lost in the daily grind. The glaciers, rubbing us out every day, squeezing us for everything we got. But know that things are moving more quickly around us than we can ever believe. And so we really got to do what we can to pop ourselves out of our any kind of daily regimented mindset. I think in order to get a better handle on just what being alive is, you know, and that we're here. Take ourselves out of, you know, chasing the bills and getting stuff done, or, you know, our anxieties. And that's where, you know, even sitting outside for a minute, catching a couple rays of sunshine and taking some slow, deep breaths and trying to figure out, you know, find yourself inside your body.
Thank you, Sensei. Almighty Todd, ladies and gentlemen, on Troubadours and Rock on Tours, regular contributor up in Stockbridge, Vermont. Pleasure talking with you.
So good to talk to you, my friend. Take care, and we'll be in touch.
Yeah, hopefully we see each other in June.
Yes. Yes, exactly. I'll get on you with that.
All right. Ciao, Fratello.
All right. Ciao.
Sweating on getting it started straight. All men, all men are liars. Their words ain't worth no more than worn out tires. Hey girls,
girls,
bring rusty pliers to pull this tooth. All men are liars, and that's the truth. All men are liars, and all men are liars, all men are liars, all men are liars, and that's the truth.
An excerpt from the Dhammapada, Buddhist Teachings, Chapter 1, Twins. Forerun by mind or mental states, ruled by mind, made of mind. If you speak or act with corrupt mind, suffering follows you, as the wheel, the foot of the ox. Forerun by mind or mental states, ruled by mind, made of mind. If you speak or act with clear mind, happiness follows you, like a shadow that does not depart. He insulted me, he struck me, he defeated me, he robbed me. For those who get caught up in this, hatred does not cease. He insulted me. He struck me. He defeated me. He robbed me. For those who do not get caught up in this, hatred ceases completely. For never here do hatreds cease by hatred. By freedom from hatred, they cease. This is a perennial truth. Others do not understand that we must control ourselves here. But for those who do understand this, through it, their quarrels cease. If you live contemplating the fair, unrestrained in senses, not knowing moderation in food, dull of weak effort, Mara overthrows you as the wind an ill-rooted tree. If you live contemplating the foul, well-restrained in senses, knowing moderation in food, confident, raising effort, Mara does not overthrow you as the wind a rocky mountain. If someone who is not freed from stain puts on the yellow robe, devoid of self-control and truthfulness, he's not worthy of the yellow robe. But if someone has got rid of the stains, well-established in the precepts, endowed with self-control and truthfulness, he indeed is worthy of the yellow robe. Those who imagine value where there's none and don't see value where there's value do not understand value. Dwellers in the realm of wrong thought. Those who perceive value when there's value and know value where there's none understand value. Dwellers in the realm of right thought. As rain penetrates an ill-roofed house, passion penetrates an undeveloped mind. As rain does not penetrate a well-roofed house, passion does not penetrate a well-developed mind. He is sorry here, after death he is sorry. In both places the evildoer is sorry. He is sorry, he is tormented, seeing his own action was defiled. He is happy here, after death he is happy. In both places, the doer of good is happy. He is happy, he is joyful, seeing his own action was pure. He suffers here, after death he suffers. In both places, the evildoer suffers. He suffers thinking, I have done wrong, and going to a bad place, he suffers even more. He rejoices here, after death he rejoices. In both places, the doer of good rejoices. He rejoices thinking, I have done right. And going to a good place, he rejoices even more. Though you recite much scripture, if you are unaware and do not act according, you are like a cowherd counting others' cattle, not a sharer in the wanderer's life. Though you recite little scripture, if you go from Dhamma to Dhamma, abandoning passion, hatred, and delusion, rightly knowing, with well-freed mind, not clinging either here or in the other world, you are a sharer in the wanderer's life. Chapter 2, Awareness. Awareness is the place of the deathless. Unawareness is the place of death. The aware do not die. The unaware are as though dead already. Knowing this especially about awareness, the wise delight in awareness, taking pleasure in the realm of the noble ones. Those who constantly practice meditation, ever firm in their endeavor, those wise ones touch Nibbana, the unsurpassed peace of yoga. If you're effortful and mindful, pure indeed, acting with consideration, controlled, living by the Dhamma, and aware, your fame will increase. By effort, awareness, restraint, and self-control, the wise one should make an island which the flood will not overwhelm. Foolish, unwise folk indulge in unawareness. The wise one guards awareness as the finest treasure. Do not indulge in unawareness or closeness with sense pleasures. For aware, meditating, you'll gain great happiness. When a learned one, by awareness, wards off unawareness, he ascends the palace of wisdom, and sorrowless observes the sorrowful folk, wise watching fools, as one on a mountain sees those on the ground. Aware among the unaware, fully awake among the sleeping, the wise one goes, leaving them behind, as a swift horse leaves a weak horse behind. By awareness, Maghavan became the chief of the gods. Folk praise awareness. Unawareness is always blamed. The monk who delights in awareness, seeing the danger in unawareness, moves like a fire, burning up fetters, small and great. The monk who delights in awareness, seeing the danger in unawareness, not liable to fall back, is close to Nibbana. Viva! Through the open windows of my automobile, I witness and hear the sweet sounds and smells of nature, seemingly subservient and servile. Though those who know, know, the true power and beauty lies all therein. Trueness of truth before, now, and then. As to, for all existence, the beautiful green, white, yellow, red, orange, violet, and blue are beyond now, me, and so wonderfully you, too.
Viva! Episode 226 of Troubadours and Rock On Tours, with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. I'd like to thank those folks who made this episode possible. First and foremost, my good friend up there in Stockbridge, Vermont, Almighty Todd. Thank you, sir, for sharing your insight and soulfulness and good humor with us. I also like to thank the Buddha for sharing with us the many teachings and ways of human existence that you've compiled over the millennia. I also like to thank these musical artists: Willie Mason, Rage Against the Machine, Nick Lowe, CeeLo Green, the Kosoy Sisters, Branford Marsalis, and Terrence Blanchard, too. And I'd like to thank my mom, Chiara Luis Pugliese, for being the best mother I could have ever hoped for. Happy Mother's Day. This and most of our archived episodes can be found at Podomatic.com. Check out EW Conundrum and you'll find them. Also on iTunes and at the WFTE website as well. Until next week, have a great this week. And thank you to all the listeners in Kenya, Uganda, in Somalia, in France, England, Italia, Argentina, our listeners in Norway and Sweden as well. Scandinavia, we love you. Yes, we do. In China, in the United States of America, from San Francisco to Scranton, PA, to New York City, where everybody's slick. From Minnesota, down to Austin, Texas. It's so, so wonderful to know you're out there. Take care.